meeting to order. We were at some point or other.
Mr. Chairman, we were having the Jan from the department go through it section by section. They're still on their way, I think.
I got a meeting at 6:00. Somebody kicked in $60,000. And that railroad thing in Fairbanks, somebody kicked in $60,000. That's just like that cover up down at Brown's Court. You got $25,000 for that one.
So all that primary, what day?
22nd.
22nd August.
And the 7th in November.
Well, let's see, we get out of here now.
Mr. Chairman?
Any shape to start back on this thing?
The department should be here in 1 or 2 minutes. They are physically on their way.
Okay, we'll draw first.
There you are. Chair, I think we were going through the bill. I think we're on line 28 of page 10, is that right?
Okay, that section is a housekeeping measure. We have deleted section 380 from the existing law, and we're recreating those parts into new sections so that we could stipulate the various things, like we combined that voluntary quit, discharge from misconduct, and refusal of suitable work with one punishment, one disqualification all together, and so we've rearranged the various sections. Okay, on page 11, line 9, section F, an insured worker whose occupation has been abolished will not be allowed to look for a job in that occupation, which makes sense. Okay, section 25, this is not, in effect, a new section. It is merely the old section 380, parens 9, I believe. Section 232387, disqualification from misrepresentation, is a new section. And gives the department a little bit of latitude in how much or how large a disqualification a person should have when they have misrepresented facts on their claims. A lot of our, or I won't say a lot, we do have claimants who come in who will misrepresent a fact because they don't know the law, and you don't want to punish them totally because they were ignorant. And so we're putting in some latitude here to allow the department no one gets away with that. And again, we have a provision in here that there must be evidence that he clearly intended to the fraud. Section 388 is a new section, disqualification for benefits upon conviction of fraud. Okay, once we take someone to court and we know and have proven that he has committed out and out fraud, we're going to come down pretty hard, a lot harder than we have been. What we're going to say is all the wage credits up to that time or some point in there are going to be wiped out, and in order to qualify for unemployment insurance benefits again, he will have to go back to work and reestablish himself as a working member of the labor force. The courts have been coming down, haven't they? Page 13, line 18. Again, here are language changes. And again, in section 27, we have language changes only. Also, section 28. Okay, in section 29, we have something beyond language change. Okay, under the current law, we try to provide hearings, we do provide hearings for all claimants. What we are providing, though, is written hearings for claimants who do not live anywhere near a local office. Those claimants in the bush areas, rather than having an appeal referee fly out to St. Paul or wherever, they reply in written form or have someone prepare a brief for them, giving their sides of their appeal. This is being contested at the present time. The courts do not think that a written interrogatory should be used. We have it here saying we would use it. The problem was the feds only fund us for the number of appeals we do. They don't fund us for travel, for going out, or for having an appeal referee on the road for a week. If he's only doing two or three cases, he only gets paid for the two or three cases. And with our federal formula, we didn't think we'd be able to absorb the cost of going out and having people unavailable.
I might add on that, at the present time, we're exploring the use of telephonic hearings for appeals to all these various areas. And it's kind of a pilot project, and we think it's going to work, and this is what we're after now, so we need this along with the telephonic hearings. You don't have phones, we're in trouble.
The cost is going to be a hell of a lot more than a cure.
Okay.
Probably cheaper to put phones in. Okay, section 30 is again a housekeeping, a change in section numbers. Section 31, I think this came from another bill and was combined in here. Was there another bill floating around?
That's House Bill 602, which was introduced by the Ombudsman.
House Bill 602 refers to, I was told, Commissioner Appeals. They must be decided within 60 days, and that's what we have here. Okay. 2324-85, false statements to secure benefits. What we've done is to include it if a person intends to draw benefits fraudulently, even though he hasn't received them yet, because we've held up for some reason, we thought there was a possible...
And you caught it.
And we've caught it before he's received any benefits. Right now, we cannot prosecute. And we're saying if he's intended to, but he merely hasn't been able to pick his benefits up yet, well, he's committed fraud and he should be penalized also. And the fines and the imprisonment has been extended.
The old fine was $200 and 60 days in jail. Now it'll go to 500 in 6 months.
Okay, in section 232490, the employing unit has been extended to refer to referral agencies also. This is because referral agencies will be verifying or certifying UI claimants for searching able available and searching for work. And again, also they've increased the penalties for employers and referral agencies from $200 or 60 days to $1,000 and 1 year. And section 34, I'd like to have someone from Labor and Management give the intent for this section. We're not really sure what was intended by this. It's the extension of the base period.
Carl, are you chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if you can, while Mr. Leep is refreshing his mind, if Joe McKinnon was the one that Representative McKinnon requested, he had a request from some people that were working, and then they were injured. And they've got, so their earnings stopped at that point. And they went to the hospital, got whatever work was necessary medically, drew whatever compensation they could, but they couldn't return to work. And we weren't asking that their eligibility carry forward from that point, but whatever they'd accrued at that point be locked up the same as if they were working. And if, for instance, if he'd been eligible for $50 at that point, or $80, whatever it was, he'd maintain that eligibility until such time as he could go back to work. He could draw his benefits now. Ms. Oldacre said that some states that have this have a three-year cutoff.
Okay, this sounds different from what's written in the law, though. This is what we're having a problem with.
Well, the way this is written in the law, we have a problem with it, because if a guy's injured for 5 years and he doesn't go back to work, we wouldn't even have these records on file. And the department, of course, did not introduce this particular section of law, and we do not support this section of law that would allow him to go back because of a workers' comp injury.
Mr. Green.
Do I hear the reason for that again? Did you state it?
Well, if a guy was injured, say he fell and hurt his back, and for some reason he was off work for 3 or 4 years, what this is you've got to go back and try and reestablish what his wages were 4 years ago so you could pay him unemployment insurance based on that period of wages. And we probably wouldn't even have the guy's wages on file from 4 years ago, because, you know, we don't keep our records back that far.
Well, is there a way we can overcome the administrative hassle? We're not too concerned with that here.
Well, and not only that, of course, we feel that this is not the part of unemployment insurance to take and fund some guy that was injured on the job and couldn't work when he's already drawn his workman's comp. Some states have it, but we don't. And if it does go in, we would ask a limitation on it.
Mr. Meekins.
Well, I think, you know, the department does have a point probably in terms of the administrative problems. It seems like a good idea in a sense to me, and I sort of agree with Clark. Maybe you could just require that he supply proof that's sufficient to you. And if he can't supply it, you know, even if you don't have the records, he has to supply the proof, and if you don't consider it sufficient,
There should be a limitation on it.
Yeah, other states who do have this same provision have a three-year limitation. You may go back 3 years. Because we need a year's data in order to establish a benefit year for him. Okay, we look at a year, so that's 3 years, we can go back and we'll look at the fourth year. But once we get beyond the fifth year, they're no longer in archives. We've had this problem.
So that'd be fine.
I don't have any problem.
Section 35 is a type of housekeeping. What we're trying to do is look at an employer's experience rating at a more closely. If he's in construction, but he's also in retail, and he's also in something else, we'll look at each entity he has and say, okay, construction industry generally runs this type of taxes, and we'd like to include him in those types rather than taking a conglomerate and saying, well, predominantly you're in this industry, but you've got many other industries underneath you. And we're only looking at very broad general categories. There's only 10, and that's what we're looking at. It's breaking out to look at better statistics than whatever. Lastly, we have new definitions for prevailing wage. And a definition for average annual wage, which is being used many times. Okay, we also have the The department, of course, has some technical amendments to make. One of them is changing this definition of average annual wage. Other suggestions that were given to us from the feds on the last few proposals were shown them. And some language from the Attorney General's office as a savings clause. And from what we heard yesterday, there seems to be some misconception, and Jim and I have been trying to figure it out, and I'm not sure we have all our things together yet. We were called here rather quickly. But trying to figure out exactly what is in our savings clause and if it's doing what is intended or what they thought they were trying to do. Do you want to go into that? Or do you want to wait?
Mr. Meeker.
Okay, we'll look at it.
What we should go into that is we take the amendments in the market.
Does that conclude your... That concludes the presentation?
Yes, it does.
Questions from the committee?
I have a lot of changes in the effective dates as soon as we finish marking up the bill. There are some technical errors that someone else made. But I guess I also want to say, are you planning to change the effective date? This one does have October 1st, and we did testify yesterday we'd like to see January 1st.
You mentioned earlier that you had some technical amendments. You mean you have them prepared to offer?
They are prepared, and Mr. Baldwin does that.
Questions from the committee? No, thank you very much. Does someone else testify? I missed last night's meeting, so I don't know who testified in there. Mr. Meekin?
Mr. Chairman, if there is no one else to testify, the way I'd like to proceed is to have a listener suggest amendments to the committee substitute. I'd just like to go through them and propose them and see how the committee wishes to dispose of the question. And based on that, I think I got 8 or 9, maybe 10 amendments to propose to the committee substitute. And then we'd like, based on that, to take a vote on moving the bill out. And who's goes there out, then we could have a committee substitute draft it up on that basis.
Mr. Meekins, would it be your intention to explain, go through and explain the amendments to us and then come back and move on them?
I went through them yesterday. Explaining them briefly, I think the members, except for yourself, are probably somewhat familiar with them, and I'll explain them as I move them.
All right. Later. Mr. Chairman Green?
No.
All right.
Mr. Shea, I have one small question. I noticed on page 16, I'm assuming the language or referral agency is new language. And I was wondering. I notice also that you have a definition for your language employing unit. I was wondering if there was any consideration to the definition of the referral agents. It might not be that important, but I'm just curious.
Section 22 of the bill. There is a semi-definition of mace or price, I'm not sure.
Another question, Mr. Meekin, was it your intention to move the proposed amendment to the administration at all?
Yes. The technical amendments?
Yeah.
What I've done is there have been suggested amendments by some of the people that testified, like Mr. Ben Dixon, on the effective date. I've written that down, and I plan to move that as my suggestion also. And there's also a suggestion by Mr. Green for an amendment in regards to school districts. I think someone plans to move that. If not, I might move that.
All right. Anyone else, Mr. Meekin, proceed.
Okay, I have the list of amendments and concept here, so some of them, the exact words we'll have to get from some of the people that have it. But the first one I have on my list is the language that it's attempting to get at the problem that 40% of the... Charlie, could you close those windows? Attempting to get at the...
Speaking, would you give us page and line as best you can so we can go along?
Okay, I'll try to. It's the amendment on out-of-state benefits. Section 18. Okay, page 7. The amendment that I'm trying to get to here is the one that 40% of our benefits go out of state, and what we're trying to do is lower the benefits for people that are living out of state, because we don't think it's right that they receive the same weight, same benefits per week as someone who's here because of the cost of living differential. And I think there's some suggested language by the Attorney General. Don't we have that? And I don't have it before me, so perhaps you could read it, and then I'd move that language.
Okay. The language suggested by the Attorney General for Section 18 reads as follows. AS 2320-350 is amended by adding new subsections to read. E, benefits may not be denied or reduced to any individual solely because he files a claim in another state or because he resides in another state at the time he files a claim for unemployment compensation. However, benefits paid to an individual filing a claim in a state other than Alaska, which has an average weekly wage which differs from Alaska's average weekly wage by 10% or greater, shall be equal to the percentage his Alaska benefit amount bears to the applicable Alaska average weekly wage multiplied by the applicable weekly wage of the state in which he is filing a claim. In this subsection, average weekly wage of a state means the average annual wage of that state divided by 52. Subsection F, the average annual wage for each state under E of this section will be computed after June 30th and before December 15th of each year based on the four consecutive calendar quarters ending June 30th. The average annual wage will be rounded to the next higher thousand prior to determining the average weekly wage to be used in E of this section. This determination is the applicable average annual wage for the period beginning January 1 of the next year and ending December 31st.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meekin.
I'll move it and then explain it. I'm sure somebody will object. I'll move the amendment.
Don't you think, in fairness to the committee, that we should have that in writing before?
Okay.
One copy is made, Mr. Chairman. Some of it's window glass.
Just explain what it does.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Macon.
We discussed this at length last night orally. What we're trying to do is lower the benefits of those people outside. The language is concocted by the Attorney General because the feds supposedly aren't going to let us do that. He says this is the best way, you know, lawyers tell us this is the best way to maximize the possibility that they will get by. And it just gives a formula for reducing it, essentially.
Okay. In your section analysis, there is an example under the Labor and Management Committee, and the idea is the same, and the same thing will be happening, except the benefit amount has changed.
We say we're not going to deny your right, on the other hand, you're here by
Ms. Buckle.
Okay, John, if the monthly, the weekly wage is lower than the state of Alaska, it is lower, you don't worry about it, but it's only when it's higher. You confuse me.
Okay. If their average weekly wage is 10% different from ours, okay, then we would reduce their benefits. So we're saying we have a range. We're saying from about, if their average annual wage was from about 21 to 25, and ours is 23, they'll get the same benefit amount we get. But if theirs is below it, like it's 14,000, which, or 15,000, where the other states are going to be next year, then yes, they will receive a reduced benefit.
Basically, what it says, there is no state that's within 10% of ours. All states will have a reduction in benefits.
Saying.
Mr. Freeman.
Question. When did the Attorney General come up with this language? How long have you had this?
Not very long. He just thought of these new developments fairly recently.
Along how long? Yesterday?
He's out of town.
The day before yesterday?
Last week.
Last week? You know, I don't want to be rude, but there's no justification for you coming with an amendment. Closed memo like this that isn't printed up so we can have it forced to read it.
Okay, I have had it in the...
Huh?
It's my fault, my amendment.
The same thing applies to you.
I'm aware of that.
Only more so.
Yeah.
And more so, you know better.
Give me another typist, I keep two.
Okay, Mark, did you have some...
Well, I think the amendment says the same thing as the language here, except it's got that, with a few minor changes, except it's...
What it has
maybe
in it
more
is
palatable to the
in the federal law, it says you will contain the following provision, and that is the first sentence I read. So he said, let's put it in the law. That's what they want.
Mr. Meek.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's one explanation is that what I was originally going to do is have a committee substitute prepare a work draft from my subcommittee, and we did have that prepared. For two reasons, I decided not to work off of it. The first reason was that there were some additional amendments after we had it worked up. I thought some more amendments, and so it wasn't really a complete committee substitute. And secondly, it seemed to me to be much more complicated to have a committee substitute and then have to be leaping back and forth. I thought we'd just work on the bill before us and I'd propose amendments one by one. But since I made that decision yesterday, I don't have the amendments prepared as well as I should. If we had more time, I would have asked for a delay, but we've been delaying this bill for so long that I just barged ahead. I apologize for that. I think you're right.
Okay, Mr. Green.
Well, why don't we go on to the other amendments? We can get that one duplicated.
Come back to it.
Okay. As far as I'm concerned, if you know if everybody else understands, and now I understand what you're trying to do, I don't have any objection to that.
Why don't we go ahead with the next amendment? Wait until others then run off and come back to
them. Okay, the next one I have on my list, these aren't in any rational order, but the next one is the amendment proposed by several different speakers, people who testified, and that's to change the effective date of the act. Do we have the language and the work? I guess we'll be at the end of the bill.
Just change
the
language.
Section 41 on the last page of the bill, change October 1st, 78 to January 1st, 79. I move that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, there's been an amendment moved to change in section 41 the effective date from October 1, 1978 to January 1, 1979. Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing no objection, the amendment carries.
Maybe we could go to this amendment now, back to it, now that members have it before. I'm pretty sure everyone on the committee agrees with what we're trying to get at here, and I think this is probably the best attempt. It's we thought of a lot of different ways to do it. We thought of keying it to the cost of living. We thought of keying it to a lot of different differentials, but it's Attorney General's opinion and some other staff that this is probably the best way to get at it. I think it's probably is, so I'd move again this amendment.
Just a question.
Okay.
Now, what's the policy in the other state as far as them migrating to another state and getting a differential over there?
They don't do it. The feds have ruled that it is, and the feds have put legislation in that you may not reduce a claimant's benefit amount because he is filing in another state.
This is contrary to that.
Yes, it is.
I might comment on this.
Mr. Chairman, I've been through this a few times before, and we tried this here maneuver once before, and we were ruled out of conformity.
I can comment on this. First off, many of the states are watching this, and they hope we get away with it because they will try the same thing. What you're talking about was back in several years ago, we paid benefits of $20 a week outside the state of Alaska, and that's all. The state of Wyoming paid 75% of their WBA. The federal government passed legislation and said you could not reduce benefits strictly because the individual filed from another state. We are not doing that. We're just saying if their average weekly wage, true, it's a roundabout way, but we think it's a legitimate way of trying to reduce this benefit amount. And even though no other states have it, I'm on the Interstate Conference for Employment Security Agencies and meeting with the other directors. They are all, a good share of them are hoping this transpires because like the state of New York and some other ones, then we'll attempt to do the same thing. Alaska's being a pilot state, so to speak.
I'm not going to make a big issue out of it. I just figured you might get to see a butterfly.
Never hurts to ask.
No. It all depends on what you're asking.
Okay. Is there further comment on this?
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Chairman, as we discussed last night, I think we should make it very, very clear that we can be found out. I mean, we may be. It's going to be a matter of interpretation. But that's the other reason for putting that savings clause in, so that we don't have to retroactively go back. So we're really not, as far as we know, going to suffer as a result of giving it a try.
Okay, just another question. Okay, in that case, what happens to our, what happens to the effect on our trust fund? We base our benefits and in towards the trust fund. If we get reversed on this rule, then we have a deeper invasion into the trust fund.
I think Janet can respond to that. I think she's done some comparisons of if we did not reduce and if we did reduce.
If we have to go back, we will have the money available at the end of the 2 years when we believe the case will be resolved, and it will not have a substantial hard impact on the trust fund. You may have to stay at the same tax rate rather than drop, or you may possibly go up a tax rate depending upon when we get the benefits out, when the decision is made, and when the tax rate is assigned.
Okay, I have another question.
Mr. Puggett.
Okay, I'm thinking about cabin workers now. Most of them are migrants, and thank God we've got them, you know, at those times of the year when they need them. What if they, for instance, they haul them out of Seattle or California, or where's the tax base? Their employment entitlement on UI, where do they set the base for their people UI check? What takes precedence?
Wherever state they file their initial claim from, that's what they'll be paid on. If they file it from Alaska, they'll be paid on the Alaska formula. If they file it from Washington, it'll be Washington. If they go to Oregon, it'll be Oregon's. Wherever they travel and file their claim, they'll be paid on the basis of that state's, percent of that state's average weekly wage based on our formula for each week they file from whatever state they file from.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one point that I don't know what points have been made or what committee understands, but the savings clause would mean that you wouldn't get into a situation where you have to pay retroactively. I think that's the benefit. And I have that, what we just passed out is that savings clause. That's going to be my next amendment.
Okay. Okay, is there objection to the amendment on page 7 that relates to section 18? There has been a motion made previously. Is there objection to the amendment? Hearing no objection, the amendment carries. The next section would be on page 18, section, it says 27, I guess it means 37, isn't it, right?
Yeah, it must mean 37, yes.
It does mean 37.
Yes, it means 37. Chairman, this is the savings clause. It's possible that there might be some technical, the legislative staff has been, affairs attorney has been attempting to write this in a better manner. It's exactly the same, but just, I guess, better legal wording. And so he's, although we have this language here, he's asked me to move this this language or something substantially the same. Is that possible, Mr. Chairman? If not, we can try to address it later, but he thinks he can write it better, and he just didn't have a chance before the meeting was working on.
Well, I think it's too late to wait for it.
You know? Okay, then I'll move the language.
Okay. Mr. Green.
Just for a second. What Secretary of Labor's action, what action are we talking about?
Each year, the Secretary of Labor has to certify our law as complying with federal law in those areas that they demand compliance. Okay, on October 1st, if our law isn't in compliance, he will send a letter to the governor saying your law is out of compliance, do something about it, or you will lose your administration funds for the Employment Security Division.
Is he likely to do that, or is the action going to come from the claimant?
The action will come from the Secretary of Labor first, because before this bill becomes effective, the Secretary of Labor will be looking at it, and he will do the first. They constantly review our law. He'll come out with an initial finding, say, what you just passed in your legislature we don't like. We'd like you to change it. You have so many days or till such and such a time to do it.
And so the state then brings an action?
There's a set procedure that we go through. They notify us. We have an appeal period. It'll take approximately up to 2 years before we finally get nailed on this if we're held out of conformity. Before they actually withdraw the funds.
Okay. I'm going to try on an amendment to the amendment, okay? Down where it says section 38, which is the second paragraph there, I would move and ask unanimous consent to insert the word final before judicial determination. The way it reads now, as I would interpret it, the first court that decides that the bill's not in compliance with the federal law, then the law is repealed automatically without reference to what might happen in the Court of Appeal.
Where's your amendment?
Russ, it would be in section 38, it would read section 18 is repealed so and so at the time that a final judicial determination.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there objection to the amendment to the amendment? If not,
indicated, shouldn't this be parallel? Well, we've got 3404C, then we refer to 3408A9A. Well, what's the difference between the two there?
In 3304A9A, that's the specific provision that says you will not reduce benefits to a claimant because he's filing out of state. 3304C is the provision that says the Secretary of Labor will certify your law.
Okay.
We've got a little hiatus here. I'd like to make another motion. that would be to put a period after A, move to amend the, once again, the original amendment, to put a period after that A in parens, scratch off becomes final, and also insert the words is made after judicial determination on the second line.
Is made.
Yeah, so what it says is section 18 of this act is repealed, so forth, at the time that a final judicial determination is made that AS so-and-so are not consistent. Okay. I hear no objection that the amendment to the amendment is adopted. Okay. Is there further discussion now of this amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? If there's no objection, the amendment is adopted.
Chairman, next, while all the members are here and before someone has to leave, I'd like to get to the substantial, controversial amendments.
Okay.
That one was unanimous. I don't know if these will go that way. One major question, of course, before us is what maximum level to assume. I'd like to move the schedule that members have a copy of. That would make the upper limit for no dependents 150 and for three dependents 175.
Say we have a copy of it.
This is showing this thing here.
It's this one, yeah.
Okay, there's a question about the uniformity of the benefits to dependents and how that works. Whether there is uniformity or whether, because it may be a problem from an administrative standpoint if it is.
Okay, what was the specific question on
that? My question was, if you're paying $25 at 150 and you have $25 dependents allowance, are you saying that's going to be so much a piece, or is that a 2 at 10 and 1 at 5? Or one of the reasons we had proposed the $7 per dependent was to get a uniform. So that always it was uniform.
The intent there is it's 10 and 10 and 5. So that, well, that's just done so you, pardon me?
You say that.
And does that apply all the way through? At $35 a week, does that apply at 10 and 10 and 5?
Yeah. Just a second, let me find out what we're
doing. What page are we looking at? Page 6?
No, it's on the
machine. I know, but that's captured on this schedule. Yeah, this schedule.
Page 6? Yeah, it should be the schedule in there.
Well, how does it fit on there?
It's page 6.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, in adopting this now, Russ, we're talking about.
I got another paper coming that's just. This is a comparison of several different bills, so it's hard to read. I've got one that's just my amendment, and it's being copied right now. We'll be here in a couple minutes, so it'd be clearer, and that would replace these.
Just so those people know, what is the estimated increase in employers' contributions under your amendment?
cost to the program for benefits will go up 61%. Okay, some employers won't see an increase, some will see a doubling. Okay, I can't give you what one employer will see.
What employers will get doubled?
Those employers, like if the tax base goes to 100% of the average annual wage, anybody who's paying over $20,000 would have a doubling.
Mr. Chairman, in a sense, you can't really say which ones now because there's another question we have to, there's another amendment that will determine that. The taxable wage base, if we increase that, then you're talking about those employers whose employees are making, you know, a lot of more than 10,000, say 20,000 or 30,000, they're going to have their contributions increase substantially. And those employees, employers have employees that are lower on the scale won't be increased very soon if that amendment's adopted. If not, I guess you could say that the 61% is the ballpark increase that you're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, are you taking comments at this time on this increased bill, how the department stands on it for the increased benefits?
If you'd like to offer some comments, I'd be glad to hear.
Yes, sir. The department, based on the governor's bill, is in opposition to increasing benefits to $175 with dependents. The position of the department is that the benefits should be a maximum of $151 with dependency allowance or without dependency allowance. We still take the stand to that we would like to see dependency allowance done away with. And part of our rationale is that the CPI from October 73 through January 78 increased 54%. And if you take the $90 a week and increase that by 54%, you come up with $138 a week as the for the increase. So this is one of the stands, but it's, like I say, this is a department stand that the maximum to be paid should be $150 with or without dependency allowance, and we still feel dependency allowance should be excluded.
Right, the basis that you just gave, that'd be a 51% increase?
Up to 151, that'd be about 52%, from 90 to 150. Without dependency allowance. With dependency, it's a little less.
Okay, Russ?
Mr. Chairman, the point I was going to make was that there's, of course, we're talking about 61% over the existing situation, not 61% over the committee substitute. So the committee substitute, I guess he said, was 52 and this was 61. So that's the range we're working in. Also, I think it's been, I'm not sure how many years it's been, I think it's been 5 years since there's been a change in this area, and at the rate of inflation that we've had, it's higher than the rate of inflation. 61% is higher than inflation, but it's not much higher than it. So you're talking about an increase in real terms, yes, but most of that increase is just keeping up with inflation because it hasn't been, there is no escalator on these benefits, of course. But the wages, of course, have been escalating, but we have a fixed amount that we pay on, which we'll be getting to in the next amendment. And that's why one of the reasons why I think we should raise that fixed amount, because we're only paying on the first 10,000. I think it should be higher.
Well, okay. If a person wanted to raise that question about the dependents, I would suppose that what we do here is to just cross out any reference to dependents. Right? Or is there further, I guess it would be further reference to dependents all the way through the law, wouldn't it? Or is it?
All of it's out.
Okay. In this way, we keep that same problem, I believe, no matter whether there's two people in the family working, the other person gets to collect unemployment for the children. Is that right? Is that the way it is? Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Buckle.
I think that we should put the dependents section in there. I think that there are some people who do have dependents, and if the concern is that there is a lack of authenticating process where we could authenticate the claim. If that is the problem, then I would go along with the process. But if we just eliminate it because it causes some problems, there are some people that will suffer by it. I would rather see that we include it, even if we have to include a section that would require a mandatory disclosure of some sort.
I have to say, speaking for myself, it's my understanding the bill had a maximum of $150. It doesn't. It has a maximum of $175. That's just an observation that relates to my understanding of the bill. Anyway, Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't started on it yet, but I don't know why we couldn't have an amendment that says the benefits payable under the dependency part of it. So you got none, one, two, or three are dependent on adequate proof, and then put in that. Put in a repealer section of that. If it's challenged, then you go back to the single column. In other words, you repeal those sections and those columns dealing with dependent. And is that too technical to work out now? It doesn't look that complicated.
Well, I'm sure we can work it out, but the dependency, you know, it is an administrative nightmare at the present time. And it could be worked out, and it would be helpful if we had something in the law that says they had to prove their dependence. I really have strong hang-ups with trying to put an amendment in, like Mr. Cooper mentioned, that if the wife's working and the husband is unemployed, and he won't be able to claim the dependence. Because you run into divorce families and common law and all these other things, and you're opening up a can of worms that's unbelievable.
I don't think it's unbelievable. I think it's possible to administer. It's difficult. Well, and that's the way it is.
Mr. Chairman? Is it that amendment would appropriately go in this section, would it, or would we determine that?
I didn't bring up an amendment.
Well, I don't see a technical problem with it.
Well, here's the way it goes. Here's the way she goes. Now we promised to put this thing on the floor tomorrow, and I suppose we want to go with. I'm not going to vote for the bill the way it is, but I can be overruled off.
I agree completely with your point on dependence, and I also think that regardless of the administrative problems, I think we ought to do what we think makes the most sense, and I agree with Clark's position. I think we can do that here, and we can vote on my amendment that's currently before us, and we can have staff work up some language here, and in a half hour or so, we'll take up the dependency. I don't think it's that complicated. Do you, Clark? I think we can get that language. I think we ought to have it in there.
Yeah. Why don't we, Mr. Chairman, just try it, and then we can always bring up the amendment, reconsider the amendment, and vote on it now. And
well, okay.
We don't report it out without reconsidering.
Mr. Chairman, discussing that.
My own information to remove dependence altogether. I don't think that this is a welfare program. I think it was meant to be a welfare program. And I think my own thought is we should remove dependence completely.
Well, I just, think that one of the problems with unemployment insurance is that there are all these rip-offs involved, and all of us know it. And I think that I really favor taking action on some of these problems, because I think when you close some of these gaps, the reason that people have a feeling against unemployment insurance is because they know that people are ripping it off, and there's all these problems. And I think with the fraud things that we did and some of these other obvious loopholes, if we try to close them the best we can, I think that's a real improvement. We should do it, and there's no reason why we can't.
Well, isn't the question whether you have dependents or not, and then the question is, what benefits? Because if you can't prove how many dependents there are, you might as well set the benefits throughout the requirement that you maybe we ought to set move on the level of benefits.
I don't understand.
Well, let's move it at set level of benefits. Forget the dependent, you get it. Whether you got dependents or not.
I get the dependent allowance.
Take the middle column, one or two. One or two.
Just a
There is a motion now on the floor before us to set this this schedule. Is there further comment on the motion?
Mr. Chairman, what was the motion again to adopt this chart here?
No, this one.
That's it. Okay. If there's no further comment on the proposed amendment, all in favor of the amendment, raise your hand. All opposed? I didn't get that count. All in favor of the amendment, raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all opposed. All right, the amendment carries. Okay, what's the next one?
Am I on again? Right on. Okay, the next amendment we refer to, it's the taxable wage base. And currently, we only pay contributions on $10,000. So that if you make $20,000, for instance, you quit, you only pay 6 months out of the year. You're only paying half the year. And in the committee substitute, there is included already, as adopted by Labor Management Committee, and also I think suggested by the department, is an increase in that wage base. And the way they're making the increase is to take a certain percentage of the annual, of the average annual wage, which is $25,000.
Yeah, the average annual wage is $25,000.
The CS says in two steps raise it. First to 60%, which is $14,000, then to 75%, which is $19,000. I move an amendment to those two percentages, changing the 60% to 75% and the 75% to 100%. That's on page one. The effect of the, I move that, make that motion, Mr. Chairman, the effect of that amendment would be to raise from $10,000 first year, the $10,000 would go up to $19,000.
I think it would be closer to 18 than 19 was in
closer to 18.
The following
okay.
year.
And the following year it would be $25,000.
Not no, probably 23, 24. The wages will be going up each year, so right off the top of my head, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but the wage is dropping. It'll be about 23 will be the $1,000 is what we will use as the average annual wage for next year's taxes, 75% of that, and then the following year you're probably up to $24,000.
Mr. Chairman,
probably $17,000.
The policy question here, and I can see where people could disagree depending on their attitudes, but the policy question is, who should be paying for this? Right now, in terms of the guy that's making $20,000 or $30,000, he's only paying contributions on a third of his income, and yet since he's making that much, when he does draw unemployment, he draws it at a higher rate. The person that's making $10,000 a year, working say Red Holloway over here, that person's paying the whole year, paying on their entire income, and when they draw unemployment, they draw at a low rate. And the chart that we passed out showed, for instance, that in the construction industry, they contribute $25 million to the fund. And yet, since it is seasonal, they draw lots of unemployment, and they draw over $40 million out of the fund. So it's just a question. In my opinion, we should change this so that they're paying their own freight on the thing.
Okay. I'd like to hear the department's comments on the proposed amendment.
Of course, well, our original proposal under the governor's bill was 75% of the average weekly wage, and this was based on $150 a week. with raising the benefits to 175, including dependency allowance. More revenue is needed, and to protect an adequacy of the funds. And unless Janet has some figures to the contrary, I don't feel we have any objection to the 75 and the 100%, because the 60 and 75 was not the governor's recommendation in the first place.
Okay. Is there further, Mr. Swanson?
Question. If I'm as a construction worker, going to pay 100% up to $25,000, whatever my percentage is, does the employer pay an equal amount up to my earnings? $25,000
pays more.
The employer
works or pays
the
six,
employee pays a small amount, the employer pays
five,
more.
Six.
Right.
Then if I'm going to pay, I pay on $10,000 earnings now. If I'm going to pay on $25,000 earnings, how much the employee earn
the
pays
employer
on $10,000?
And the employee will both pay on that $25,000.
But what? Then the employer pays only $25,000.
And the
but
employee.
But he pays a higher percentage.
And he's paying
than I
a
do.
higher tax than you are.
Page 3 of the bill, Mr. Swanson, shows the tax rate, depending on what rate you are, and you just take that percent of your whatever rate you fell into as an employer.
Well, then give me some figure here. If I pay in, what is the average worker pay into the fund at $10,000 level?
The worker right now is only paying $80 a year.
A year.
Okay.
What is the corresponding amount for the employer?
The employer pays a rate that varies from 2.6% to 5.1%.
Give me dollar figures. Give me dollar figures.
He's paying from $260 to $510.
Okay. Mine is 80, his 510. Now when I go to 25,000, mine would be how much?
200.
And what would his, mine would be $250?
Approximately 200.
200, and his would be how much? 1250.
$1275.
I wasn't too far. $1,250 or $1,275.
Okay, but the tax base will not be $25,000 next year. It will be about $17,000.
Then it would be about $700, between $800 and $900 his contribution.
We passed the first amendment. Doesn't it require that you pass this one to fund it?
Well, first of all,